Jealousy is considered demeaning. It's unspeakable. A feeling so low that you may not admit to it. So I knew I must not ask more about Abe's new wife, but I did ask. Do we have a sister then? How old is she? Again, it was my grandmother who answered in the same strained but airy voice. Oh, she must be 9 years old now. Then my mother turned around and said in a strangled tone, No, I think 3 or 4. And in the silence that followed, all of us did the math. Our father must have married right after he left us behind, in 1981, perhaps just a few months later. I thought about my father's succession of wives and children. How he had abandoned his first children and then us, and now had made another daughter, whom I thought he would surely abandon too. I felt a sudden wave of compassion for Ma, with all her worries, trying to find us a decent house to live in, having to take charity from my father's clan, dealing with Mahat dropping out, and worrying about my wayward sister Hawea. If my father had been with us, none of this would have happened. I was also crushed. I felt as if all the hope had suddenly drained out of my bones. I almost never admitted it to myself, but in those days I still imagined in the back of my mind that Abe would come home one day and make us a proper family again, recreate that sphere of closeness and warmth. To learn that he had another child, this was a betrayal, as if he had slapped me hard in the face. In the next days and weeks, I told myself that I would never let this happen to me. I would never be dependent on anyone in this way. My mother had so little control over her own life that she hadn't even known when her husband had gotten married again. I raged internally when I thought about it. I raged for her. Life seemed to be so unfair to Ma. She could be cruel, but she was loyal to my father, and she was always there for us children. She didn't deserve any of this. I was beginning to rebel internally against women's traditional subjugation. In those days, I was still wearing a hijab. I thought a lot about God, how to be good in his eyes, and about the beauty of obedience and submission. I tried to still my mind so it would become a simple vessel for the will of Allah and the words of the Quran. But my mind seemed bent on being distracted from the straight path. Something inside me always resisted the moral values behind Sister Aziz's lectures. A small spark of independence. Perhaps it was a reaction to the stark gap between the behavior demanded by the holy writings and the realities of actual daily life with all its twists and turns. Even as a child, I could never comprehend the downright unfairness of the rules, especially for women. How could a just God, a God so just that almost every page of the Quran praises his fairness, desire that women be treated so unfairly? When the Ma'alim told us that a woman's testimony is worth half of a man's, I would think, why? If God was merciful, why did he demand that his creatures be hanged in public? If he was compassionate, why did unbelievers have to go to hell? If Allah was almighty and powerful, why didn't he just make believers out of the unbelievers and have them all go to paradise? Inwardly, I resisted the teachings, and secretly I transgressed them. Like many of the other girls in my class, I continued to read sensual romance novels and trashy thrillers, even though I knew that doing so was resisting Islam in the most basic way. Reading novels that aroused me was indulging in the one thing a Muslim woman must never feel, sexual desire outside of marriage. A Muslim woman must not feel wild or free, or any of the other emotions and longings I felt when I read those books. A Muslim girl does not make her own decisions or seek control. She is trained to be docile. If you are a Muslim girl, you disappear until there's almost no you inside you. In Islam, becoming an individual is not a necessary development. Many people, especially women, never develop a clear individual will. You submit. That is the literal meaning of the word Islam, submission. The goal is to become quiet inside, so that you never raise your eyes, not even inside your mind. But the spark of will inside me grew even as I studied and practiced to submit. It was fanned by the free-spirited novels, the absence of my father, and the frustration of watching my mother's helplessness living in a non-Muslim country. Most of all, I think it was the novels that saved me from submission. I was young, but the first tiny, meek beginnings of my rebellion had already clicked into place. Our family had never been very united, but it seemed to fall apart completely after that December. Uncle Muhammad went back to Somalia, and Mahat went with him to find his way and become a man. I was glad to see him go. He was a bully, but I was also envious. Mahat could travel and have adventures. Nothing like that could ever happen to me, because I was a girl. A month after Mahat's departure, the eviction police arrived and our household was flung into crisis. After years of clawing a few months more delay out of the owners, Ma had still not found us a place to live. It was Grandma who finally found a practical solution, through the clan network as usual, and we moved to temporary lodging in the house of an Isaag man in the neighborhood. This man, whose name was Abdullahi Ahmed, was a recent widower. His wife had died a few months before, and Grandma had spent a few weeks at his house, helping. These are the sorts of things you do for people in your clan. When he heard about our plight, Abdullahi Ahmed naturally offered to take us in. Abdullahi Ahmed had many children, but he had moved the younger ones to his farm out of town. Only his two oldest daughters, Fardausa and Amina, lived with him now in his house in Nairobi. Abdullahi Ahmed was a businessman and a Somali, so he had no idea how to bring up teenage girls. An older woman, Hanan, who was a relative, lived with them and was supposed to take care of that. We lived in one bedroom, my grandmother in one bed, Hawa and me in bunks, and my mother on a mattress on the floor. Our stuff was stored under our grandmother's bed or in various houses in the neighborhood. We shared the kitchen. Mostly Fardausa or Amina would cook for their family, and I would cook for us. Fardausa and Amina had grown up in Kenya, and both their Somali and their English were poor. We spoke to each other in Swahili, though this disgusted my mother. After dinner, we used to joke around in the kitchen, making the dough for the next morning's anchelo, the traditional Somali pancake. Amina, the older girl, was outgoing, and Hawa liked her. I preferred Fardausa, who was mild and sweet. But my mother and Hanan stalked each other like a pair of scorpions. Hanan chewed qat. My mother couldn't believe she had to live in the house of a woman who stooped to do something so low. Although qat chewing is prevalent in Somalia, Muslim doctrine opposes any kind of intoxication, and Ma saw it as particularly horrifying in a woman. Whenever Hanan chewed qat, Ma would stare at her with eyes narrowed and stomp off to our room. In the morning, when Hanan was hungover from her cat habit, she could be vicious. But after a few hours chewing after lunch, the cat made Hanan patient and pleasant to be around. Her supervision was far more lax than my mother's at the best of times. Amina and Hawa began sneaking out of the house in the afternoons. Amina had a boyfriend, Farah Gura's youngest son, the prince of the estate. He was cool and drove his own car. She was Isaag and he was Osman Mahmoud. It was terribly romantic, like Romeo and Juliet. As for Hawa, I think she mostly went to the movies. Fardausa and I began sneaking out sometimes too. We would go to the movies with Hawa, Jim Ammus's older daughter, who lived in the house directly opposite Abdullahi Ahmed's house. Hawa thought my hijab was absolutely a joke. When she saw me coming home from school in my black robe, she would howl with laughter. Then she'd pull me to the Odeon to see some improbable Bollywood epic. One day Kennedy caught sight of Hawea at an afternoon disco and asked her for news of Mahat and me, especially me. The two of us had barely seen each other since Mahat had dropped out of Starehe Boys' School, which Kennedy was still attending, in the equivalent of grade 13. In the British system, secondary school begins in grade 8. You take all levels at the end of year 11, usually called fourth form, and air levels in year 13, called sixth form. Kennedy gave Hawea a note for me with his phone number. When I saw that note, my legs shook and of course I called him. When we spoke, I stammered, and all my nerve endings seemed to come alive with excitement. My black hijab didn't shield me from the effect Ken had on me. We agreed to meet in the house of one of his relatives. In a cinema or a park, someone might see us. I went robed from head to toe. I told myself I would tell Kennedy about Allah. I would tell him that if Allah had willed us to fall in love, then we should get married one day. It was meant to be. When I rang the bell, Ken was startled to see me cloaked in black. He said, "What's happened to you? Are you mad?" I said, "No, I'm not mad. I'm taking my religion seriously. You should too." He took my hand and smiled. He was so nice, such a very nice person. Then he took me into the house, and I took off my robe and followed it, pretending there was nothing at all unusual about being alone in a house with a grown man. Underneath the robe, I was dressed in a long skirt and a blouse buttoned up to my neck. I sat on the edge of the sofa, and Ken and I made small talk for a little while. Then he kissed me, and again it was as if a switch had clicked shut in my mind. I knew the angels were watching me, but I kissed him back. When it got dark, Ken prepared dinner. I had never been served by a man. It was fun. Ken was thoughtful and kind and interesting. He indulged me. He was completely unlike my brother. After dinner, as we sat together, I asked him, "Tell me, really, your name is Yusuf, right?" Here I was, risking my soul, coming to see him. I thought I had a right to know his real name and his people. He said, "No, I told you, my name is Kennedy." I thought he was still joking, because I had convinced myself that the whole Ken thing was some kind of gag, another way for him and Mahat to tease me for being so gullible and protected from the outside world. But Ken said, "The truth is that my name is Kennedy Okyoga, and I am from the Kisii tribe. I am not Somali. Mahat invented that so your mother would accept me, because your ma is new in this country. I am Kenyan." I was stunned. I said, "So you're not a Muslim?" And he said, "No, I'm not." "But you'll have to become a Muslim," I burst out. And Kennedy began laughing. "Of course I won't become a Muslim," he said. "Then I'd have to look like you." I got all earnest and told him, "But men don't have to wear these clothes." And Kennedy said, "I know that, but I'm not going to become a Muslim." Then he told me he was an atheist, that he didn't believe in any God. I was horrified. I couldn't believe such an evil thing was possible, coming from someone so kind and so handsome. I burst out, "But you will burn." Kennedy said, "There is no hell, you know. It's all nonsense." There was a horrible silence. I realized that we must never see each other again. It didn't matter how much I liked him. I could never marry a non-Muslim. It wasn't just because of the rule that a Muslim woman must never marry an unbeliever. It was my clan's Somali bigotry as well. Ayan, Hirsi, Magan could never marry a Kenyan. The clan simply would not stand for it. If I married Ken, he might even be killed. If Ken had been willing to convert to Islam, I could have tried to argue that we are all equal under Allah, no matter the clan or tribe. Perhaps the Osman Mahmud one day could have accepted that, though all of them would certainly have sneered at me my whole life. But at age 17, even I could not conceive of marrying an unbeliever. So everything had to be over. It was horribly painful. When I left, I told him, "I really think the two of us is impossible." Ken answered, "I know about the Somalis, but love is stronger than anything. Let's give it a try." It was sweet, but futile. That kind of childish wishing was behind us. I just looked down and mumbled, "Please, can I think about it?" He knew, both of us knew, that we were saying goodbye. It was not a good time for anyone in our family. A few weeks later, just before she turned 16, Hawea announced that she was dropping out of school. She told me about it the night before she told Ma. I begged her not to do it. She had only 2 more years to go before her O-level exams, and she had always been so effortlessly clever. I had to work far harder than she did for worse grades. I told her, "If you don't get a diploma, you'll be nothing. You'll be like Ma." But Hawea was adamant. School was stupid. She wanted to go to Somalia, like Mahat. She wanted to live anywhere but in the one bedroom we shared with Grandma and Ma. The morning after she told me about her decision, Hawea went over to Farah Gura's house, where Ma used to stride every month, head high, to accept her allowance. It was a huge courtyard, always full of Somali men, and Hawea just walked in, wearing her usual clothes, her school skirt, no headscarf. She announced, "I have come for a consultation with Farah Gura." Everyone laughed at her and told her to come back with her mother. A young girl can't just talk directly to an older man with no intermediary. But when Farah Gura emerged from his house, Hawea walked up to him and said, "I am the daughter of Hirsi Magan, and I have come to ask you a favor. You can hear it and say yes or no, or you can tell me right now, 'Go home, you are not welcome, and I won't come back.'" Farah Gura started to laugh. He asked Hawea if she wanted a cup of tea, and she said, "No, I want to go to Somalia." Just like that. She said, "My brother is in Mogadishu, my family is in Mogadishu, and my father will be in Somalia soon when Siad Barre is finally defeated. I don't want to be in Kenya anymore. I have dreamt of Somalia since I was a little girl, and I know you go there twice a month, so please take me." Farah Gura asked, "Does your mother know this?" And Hawea said, "Yes, she does. If you agree to take me, she will let me go," which wasn't true, of course. Farah Gura was quite a character. He was small and round, and Osman Mahmud. We shared the 9th grandfather, I think. In 1987, he must have been about 60, and though he couldn't read or write, he owned a whole fleet of trucks that travelled all over eastern and southern Africa. But although Farah Gura had made his wealth from his own initiative and efforts, it wasn't his in the way that a Westerner's wealth belongs to him alone. Farah Gura believed in the clan and in the SSDF. By taking care of the SSDF families in Kenya, he believed he freed his countrymen to fight. It was the sort of thing the Osman Mahmud have always done. Farah Gura shared his money and good fortune with the clan and the cause. His house was open to almost any Osman Mahmud who wanted to be there. Much later, we heard the story of how he met Fadumo, his wife. When Farah Gura was 15, he left his parents to make his fortune. That's the tradition in Bari, where he was born. A man must prove himself alone. So Farah Gura left Bari and went to Kismayo, in the south. He was young, he didn't understand the people or the accent in Kismayo, and there was nobody looking after him or doing his laundry. His money ran out very quickly, and his clothes were a mess, but he couldn't go home a failure. The shame of it would have been intolerable. One day, walking through the market, Farah Gura saw a young woman about his age making anjelo, cooking the pancakes on a charcoal brazier on the ground, rolling them up with sugar and butter, and selling them to passers-by. He walked up and down, smelling the angelo, and she called to him, "So, you look hungry." And he laughed with relief, because her accent was from Bari. Farah Gure and this young woman started listing their ancestry, as Somalis always do. Both of them were Osman Mahmoud, so they could call each other brother and sister. He asked what she was doing in Kismayo, and this woman, whose name was Fatima, said, "I told my parents I would leave to make my fortune, and this is what I did. I have an ancello stall, but one day I'll buy a truck. You can start an ancello stall too." Fahgu said, "Of course I can't, I'm a man." Fadumo made him an ancello, and when he said he couldn't pay for it, she offered to let him earn his pancake. She said, "I'll make sure that you have breakfast every morning, and you can go and find out how the truck business works. I have to be here with the ancellos, and I'm a woman, so it's not as easy for me to look into it as it will be for you." That's how Farhgur apprenticed himself to a transporter. He and Fadumo talked every day about her dream to have trucks working all over Somalia. He offered to marry her, and she said, "Of course not. I'm not going to marry a man who can't even earn his own breakfast." They did marry in the end, of course, and after a year or so of making ancellos and renting trucks and trading between Kismayo and Mogadishu, Fadumo and Farhgur bought their first truck. Then they bought another, and a real ancello stand with employees. It was the women of the Tolka, the closest of our Osman Mahmoud relatives, who told and retold the story to us, and each time it became more romantic. Fadumo braver and wittier, and Farah even more enchanted by her. When this lovely story was told in the presence of Fadumo herself, she would listen silently, with a small smile on her face, saying nothing. She was a big, happy woman with a huge household full of children and guests, just down the road from Abdullahi Ahmed's house. When Fatima was pregnant with their seventh child, Farah Gure married another woman, and then a third. But Fatima never flinched. She told the other wives, "You're welcome here, but you earn your own money. The money he married you with is mine." I don't know how much of that story was true, but the moral lesson was clear. As a woman, you're better off in life earning your own money. You couldn't prevent your husband from leaving you or taking another wife, but you could save some of your dignity if you didn't have to beg him for financial support. I suppose that's why Farahgur decided to help her wear. He liked strong, bold women. He agreed to pay for her trip to Mogadishu and made all the arrangements. Grandma was proud of her wear. She was doing what a Darot woman should do, returning to her land to learn the ancestral traditions. But Ma was angry that Hawea had arranged all this behind her back. She knew the Osman Mahmoud women would gossip. For a daughter to leave her mother in this way reflected very badly on her upbringing. Still, Ma knew she could not stand in the way of Hawea going to Somalia to visit her father's relatives. That would look even worse. Ma had several long, flowing dira made for Hawea and pleaded with her to obey her elders and not to damage her parents' honor. When the day came for her to leave, Ma and I walked her over to Farah Gure's house with her suitcase. She was excited. I cried. Mainly I felt sorry for myself, left behind to share a bedroom with Grandma and Ma and finish school alone. Father had left years ago, then Mahat, and now Hawea was going too. Grandma talked endlessly of how much better she would feel if she were back home in Somalia again with the rest of her daughters and son. Our family was disintegrating. When she got to Mogadishu, Hawea would have to stay with our father's first wife, Marian Farah, our closest relative in Somalia. Not to stay with her would have been rude and would have sent a message of jealousy and spite. We were above all that. We had never met Marian Farah, but we knew about her and her children, whom we called our sisters. Aro was much older than I. Ichabu was close to Hawea's age. Marian was a small, proud woman and had not remarried after my father divorced her. She worked in Mogadishu in some important job for the government. Marian was Marehan, from the same small sub-clan as the dictator Siad Barre. There was a constant tug of clan the whole time Hawea was in Somalia. In Kenya, clans had never mattered much to us, but in Somalia, they were omnipresent. The Osman Mahamud understood that Hawea had to live with her stepmother, even though Marian was of another clan, because that is how these things are always done. But they wanted to keep an eye on her. They sneered at the Marehan, the clan of the upstart Afweine. They didn't want a Marehan woman saying she had to support an Osman Mahamud child, so they gave Hawea pocket money. As soon as Hawea would return to Marian's house from a visit with our father's relatives, our stepsisters would fall on her. Arro and Ichabo would plead and beg and even demand that she share the cash. They took her stuff without asking, things like shampoo and soap. They jeered at her for not knowing the proper codes and for reading all the time. Hawea didn't like them. Hawea found more congenial company at the house of Ibadadadi Magan, an older sister of my father's, who had taught herself to read and write, earned a nursing certificate, and had risen to become director of the Digfer Hospital where I was born. Ibadadadi was in her late 40s or early 50s, but she was modern. She was married, but she had no children, and she liked my sister's pluck. Ibadadadi told Hawea she was lucky to have gone to school at all, and that she needed to study so she could work for her living. She showed Hawea around her house with its tiled veranda and lush garden and told her, "Nobody gave me any of this. I worked for it. Go out and get yourself a qualification and work." When Hawea used the money Ibadadadi gave her to buy trousers, blouses and skirts, Marian's household was outraged. Food was another difficult issue. In our house in Nairobi, we never ate from one plate as Somalis do. Ma had long ago adopted the Western manner, using individual plates, though we did mostly eat with spoons or our hands. But in Marian's house, like almost everywhere in Mogadishu, all the men ate out of one plate in one part of the courtyard, and all the women and small children squatted and ate at another corner of the courtyard from another dish. Hawea disliked it. She thought it was unhygienic. It killed her appetite. She had gotten into the habit at home of eating alone, after all of us, while reading a book. It made her miserable to eat without reading, and she lost weight, which Marian took as a personal insult. Hawea began going to restaurants with the money Ibadah gave her. A young woman on her own in a restaurant. This was absolutely unheard of. She would order lunch, and then in front of everyone, she would eat it, slowly, while reading a novel. Waiters and male clients would badger her, but she just told them off. This was hugely deviant behavior. Marian's relatives began focusing on Hawea, the poor little daughter of Hirsi Magan, who had been allowed to grow up a barbarian in Kenya. They sought to influence her. They talked about her. They talked to her. All of them got involved in what she ate, when she ate, how she dressed. Why was she reading novels and not the Quran? Hawea wrote me that she had gone to Somalia to be free of our mother, but was being suffocated by an entire cabal. I was 17, and I was miserable with Hawea away. My friend Fardosa Abdullahi Ahmed had left Nairobi too to live with her younger brothers and sisters in the countryside until she was married off. In school, the only subject that interested me was Islamic education. The prospect of taking my O-level exams didn't interest me one bit. I needed to get to the core of what I believed in. All the other girls were content to accept the rules of our religion at face value, but I felt compelled to try to understand them. I needed my belief system to be logical and consistent. Essentially, I needed to be convinced that Islam was true. And it was beginning to dawn on me that although many wonderful people were sure it was true, there seemed to be breakdowns in its consistency. If God were merciful, then why did Muslims have to shun non-Muslims, even attack them to establish a state based on Allah's laws? If he was just, Then why were women so downtrodden? I began collecting together all the verses in the Quran that said God was wise, God was omnipotent, God was just, and there were many. I pondered them. Clearly, in real life, Muslim women were not different but equal, as Sister Aziza maintained. The Quran said men rule over women. In the eyes of the law and in every detail of daily life, we were clearly worth less than men. I was also still attending Quran classes alongside Muslim girls secondary. My ma'alim was a young man whom people called Baqul Sawm, he who fasts for 100 days. Grandma used to say his belly touched his spine, he was so thin. Baqul Sawm was a fanatic, even by a zealot's standard. He wore a Saudi robe, cut short so we could see his scrawny ankles. He used to walk around Eastleigh, knocking on doors and lecturing people. He told Farah Gure, "All your daughters are uncovered. All of you will writhe in hell." Farah Gure threw him out of the house. But in time, Baqul Sawm acquired a large following. Most of them were women, and among them was my mother. When he came to the door, women accepted the audio cassettes of sermons that he handed out, and they exchanged them with each other. They turned their living rooms over to Quran study, filling them with women listening eagerly to his sermons on tape or even to Baqul Sawm in person, with an opaque curtain separating him from the women, just as the Prophet had ordained. Baqul Sawm became the most sought-after lecturer in the community, and as time passed, the effect of his sermons became visible in the streets of the Somali neighborhoods. Women who used to wear colorful dirahs with seductive petticoats underneath and Italian sandals that showed off pedicured toes painted in nail varnish or henna began to clock in the burqa. They shrouded themselves in dark brown, black and dark blue cloth of the roughest cotton fabric possible, with only a little bit of their faces visible. Some even began to cover their faces. There are so many variations in exactly how you must cover yourself. The form of veil that now spread among the Somali fundamentalists was called a jilbab, a thick cloth covering everything from the head to below the knees and another thick skirt underneath. All of a sudden, my black cloak seemed too thin and revealing. My mother was drawn to Baqul Sawm's certitude. She encouraged me to listen to his sermons on tape and attend his lectures when he preached at homes in our neighborhood. With Sister Aziza, there was an atmosphere of trust and intimacy. She let us draw our own conclusions. But to Baqul Sawm, teaching the Quran meant shouting it, loud, in a mishmash of Arabic and Somali, and then yelling out the rules. What was forbidden, what was permitted. He didn't translate the text properly or explain its underlying intention. One day, when I was 17, Baqul Sawm turned to the verses on how women were supposed to behave with their husbands. "We owed our husbands absolute obedience," he told the mothers and teenage girls who had gathered to listen to him. "If we disobeyed them, they could beat us. We must be sexually available at any time outside our periods, even on the saddle of a camel, as the hadith says." This wasn't any kind of loving partnership or mutual giving. It didn't even sound possible. But Baqul Sawm yelled, "Total obedience. This is the rule in Islam." It enraged me, and I stood up behind the curtain. In a shaky voice, I asked, "Must our husbands obey us too?" "There's nothing wrong with that question," but Baqul Sawm's voice rose, hard and dry. "Certainly not." I dug my nails into my hand to stop myself from shaking and went on. "Men and women are then not equal." Baqul Sawm said, "They are equal." "But they are not," I told him. "I'm supposed to totally obey my husband, but he's not totally obedient to me, and therefore we are not equal. The Quran says on almost every page that Allah is just, but this is not just." Baqul Sawm's voice rose to a shout. "You may not question Allah's word. His mind is hidden. Satan is speaking to you, girl. Sit down instantly." I sat down, but as I did, I hissed, stupid, under my breath. It alarmed the other women in the room. They thought I truly must have lost my mind to a demon. But I knew I had genuinely sought the truth, and Bokelson had shut me up because he didn't know it. The flaw could not be in the Quran, because that's God's word. It must lie with the stupid ma'alim, with the whole inept cohort of ma'alims that it had been my unhappy lot to encounter. I thought that perhaps Bokelson was translating the Quran poorly. Surely Allah could not have said that men should beat their wives when they were disobedient. Surely a woman's statement in court should be worth the same as a man's, I told myself. None of these people understand that the real Quran is about the true equality. The Quran is higher and better than these men. I brought my own English edition of the Quran and read it so I could understand it better. But I found that everything Bokelson had said was in there. Women should obey their husbands, women were worth half a man, infidels should be killed. I talked to Sister Aziza and she confirmed it. Women are emotionally stronger than men, she said. They can endure more, so they are tested more. Husbands may punish their wives, not for small infractions, like being late, but for major infractions, like being provocative to other men. This is just because of the overwhelming sexual power of women. I asked, what if the man provokes other women? Sister Aziza said, in an Islamic society, that's impossible. Furthermore, she told me, I was not permitted for one second to imagine that perhaps the Quran's words could be adapted to a modern era. The Quran had been written by God, not by men. The Quran is the word of Allah, and it is forbidden to refute it, Sister Aziza told me. You obey and you serve Allah. That's the test. If you submit to God's will on earth, you will attain bliss in the hereafter. The rule is strict and pure. My doubts severely diminished my chances for eternal bliss, but I found that I couldn't ignore them. I had to resolve this. As Bokelson's following grew, his sermons caused a lot of quarrels between spouses. At first, the Somali fathers and husbands were amused and teased their wives, predicting that after a week, the silly, bored women would find some other pastime. After a while, however, irritations arose. The living room, usually well furnished, is the domain of the man. Somali men bring their male friends home and sit with them in the living room, having men talk. Honor, money, politics, and whether to take a second or third wife, as they drink scented sweet tea and chew qaat. The evenings and Friday afternoons are their preferred times, and Bokelson chose to give his lectures specially at those times. When Bokelson was visiting a house, the men were relegated to the women's quarters, the kitchen, backyard, and in some of the bigger houses, the smaller and uglier living rooms usually occupied by the women. And after their wives converted to the true Islam of the Muslim Brotherhood believers, they began saying that chewing qaat, smoking, and skipping prayers were forbidden. They actually sent their husbands off, calling them unbelievers. When the men shouted about disobedience, the women replied that in the hierarchy of submission, we must follow Allah even before husband and father. Allah and the Prophet decreed that wives should obey only husbands who themselves obey Allah. The Muslim Brotherhood believed that there was a pure original Islam to which we all should return. Traditional ways of practicing Islam had become corrupted, diluted with ancient beliefs that should no longer have currency. The movement was founded in the 1920s in Egypt as an Islamic revivalist movement, then caught on and spread, slowly at first, but much faster in the 1970s as waves of funding flooded in from the suddenly massively rich Saudis. By 1987, the Muslim Brotherhood's idea had reached the Somali housewives of Eastleigh in the gaunt and angry shape of Bokelson. Within months, the first divorces were occurring, and secular Somali men were threatening Bokelson for breaking up their families. Bokelson was chased away by angry husbands from the living room sessions and from the Somali mosques. but copies of his tapes continued to spread even as he was in hiding. In the tapes, when he wasn't warning about hellfire and the enemies of Islam, Boqolsom was issuing detailed prescriptions on the rituals permitted in Islam and the ceremonies of birth, lovemaking, marriage, divorce, and so on. Celebrating the birthday of the Prophet was forbidden because it resembled Christmas, when Christians celebrate the birthday of Jesus, and Muslims should never imitate unbelievers in any way. Wearing amulets, as my grandmother did, and asking favors of dead forefathers was blasphemous, as it associated Allah with lesser gods. And for that, you could ban forever. Refusing to sleep with your husband if he didn't observe the obligations of prayer and fasting was permitted. When entering a bathroom to use the toilet, start with the left foot. And when coming out, put the right leg out first. The only greeting permitted among Muslims is Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Peace be to you and the mercy of Allah and His blessings. If you are greeted in any other way, you must not answer. Boqolsom wasn't the only preacher who had come to our neighborhood to guide the lost back to Allah's straight path after a stint in Medina or Cairo. More and more young men of the Muslim Brotherhood, dressed in ankle-length white robes and red and white checked shawls, were striding through the streets. People who converted to their cause started to collect money from family. Some women gave their dowries, and all kinds of donations came in. By 1987, the first Muslim Brotherhood mosque was built in East Leigh, and Boqolsom came out of hiding to preach there every Friday, screaming at the top of his lungs through the loudspeakers behind the white minaret topped with a green crescent and a single star. Boqolsom shouted that the men who rejected their wives' call to Islam would burn. The rich who spent their money on earthly things would burn. The Muslims who abandoned their fellow Muslims, the Palestinians, were not true Muslims, and they would burn too. Islam was under threat, and its enemies, the Jews and the Americans, would burn forever. Those Muslim families who sent their children to universities in the United States, Britain, and other lands of the infidels would burn. Life on earth is temporary, Boqolsom yelled. It was meant by Allah to test people. The hypocrites who were too weak to resist the worldly temptations would burn. If you did not break off your friendships with non-Muslims, you would burn. I had questions about Boqolsom, but at age 17, I mostly believed in the Brotherhood's values. And as the movement swelled, there were two clear benefits. Fewer young men were getting addicted to qat and other drugs. At the time, AIDS was just starting to kill people. Many Muslim families thought the best answer was abstinence. And abstinence was exactly what the religious zealots of every stripe were preaching. Another benefit was a curbing of corruption. In Muslim Brotherhood enterprises, there was virtually no corruption. Medical centers and charities managed by the Brotherhood were reliable and trustworthy. If non-Muslim Kenyans converted, they too could benefit from these facilities, and in the slums, many Kenyans began converting to Islam. A brand new mosque was built in Majengo with money contributed by a rich Saudi man. One Friday evening, I went there to pray with classmates because Sister Aziza said it was important to visit poor neighborhoods. It was after the evening prayer, and the street near the mosque was crowded with Kenyan women clumsy in their new jilbabs. At the entrance of the mosque, a Kenyan woman carrying a baby had just sat down on the stone steps. She lifted her jilbab and opened the buttons of the dress she was wearing underneath, then directed a completely naked and voluptuous breast into her baby's mouth as if it was the most common act in the world. In front of her was a mountain of men's shoes, and behind her, men, strange men, were engaged in prayer, but this young woman seemed shockingly oblivious to these surroundings. All the girls from Sister Aziza's class shrieked in unison, and we transported this young woman to a hall in the women's section. An older woman of Swahili origin covered from head to toe in black, started to instruct her in the Islamic way of breastfeeding. First you say Bismillah before you put the nipple into the mouth. As the baby is feeding, beg Allah to protect your child from illness, earthly temptations, and the evil ways of the Jews. Of course, no strange man must ever be present. Better that the baby go hungry. I was never one of Boglesholm's great admirers. I thought his sermons were crude. They didn't seem to answer my questions. But I was drawn to a discussion group of young Muslims that took place in the community center near my school. These were young people who were dissatisfied with the intellectual level of the teaching at the madrasas, and who, like me, sought deeper religious learning, true understanding of the example of the Prophet Muhammad, the better to walk in his footsteps. They felt Islam should not be something you nodded at a few times a week. They wanted to immerse themselves in it as a minutely detailed way of life, a passion, a constant internal pursuit. A group of Somali and Pakistani young men had begun organizing weekly Islamic debates in English to discuss these matters. Going there was not like attending the mosque, where sermons were often just a recitation of old texts in Arabic. The speakers at our youth debate talked about relationships between men and women, Muslims and non-Muslims, Islam and Christianity. The talks were lively and often clever, as well as much more relevant to our lives than the mosque. The audience was mostly very bright, deeply committed older students, and they were there voluntarily, unlike Quran school, which parents oblige their kids to attend. Our speaker stood on a dais. The boys in front wore mainly Western clothes, and the girls behind them wore large headscarves. The segregation was voluntary, and the atmosphere was harmonious. We were all good Muslims, striving for perfection. We were not like the passive old school, for whom Islam meant a few rules and more or less devoutly observed rituals, and who interlaced their Quran with tribal customs and magical beliefs in amulets and spirits. We were God's shock troops. The Islam that we were imbibing stemmed from the hard, essentialist beliefs of thinkers seeking to revive the original Islam of the Prophet Muhammad and his disciples in the 7th century. The intention was to live according to the ancient ways in every detail of our lives. We weren't just learning a text by heart. We were discussing its meaning and how it applied to us every day. We read Hassan al-Banna, who set up the Society of Muslim Brothers to oppose the rise of Western ideas in the lands of Islam and promote a return to the Islam of the Prophet. We read Sayyid Qutb, another Egyptian, who said preaching was not enough, that we must stage a catastrophic revolution to establish the kingdom of God on earth. We thrilled to new movements called Akhwan, or Brotherhood, and Tawheed, which emphasized the oneness of Allah. They were small groups of true believers, as we felt ourselves to be. This was the true Islam, this harking back to the purity of the Prophet. Everyone was convinced that there was an evil worldwide crusade aimed at eradicating Islam, directed by the Jews and by the whole godless West. We needed to defend Islam. We wanted to be involved in the jihad, a word that may have multiple meanings. It may mean that the faith needs financial support, or that an effort should be made to convert new believers. Or it may mean violence. A violent jihad is a historical constant in Islam. As much as I wanted to be a devout Muslim, I always found it uncomfortable to be opposed to the West. For me, Britain and America were the countries in my books where there was decency and individual choice. The West to me meant all those ideas, in addition to pop music and cinema, and the completely silly pen pal relationships we had had at Muslim girls' secondary school with girls from Finland and Canada who thought we lived in trees in the jungle. In my own personal experience of the West, which was admittedly minimal, it really didn't seem to be terribly evil. But I stared long and hard at the photos of dead Muslims that were passed around. We had to give meaning to these deaths, and we were told that the West had caused them. We were taught that as Muslims we should oppose the West. Our goal was a global Islamic government for everyone. How would we fight? Some said the most important goal was preaching, to spread Islam among non-Muslims and to awaken passive Muslims to the call of the true, pure God. Several young men left the group to go to Egypt to become members of the original Muslim Brotherhood there. Others received scholarships from various Saudi-funded groups to go to Quran schools in Medina in Saudi Arabia. Sister Aziza became a Shia when she married a Shia man. She was enthralled by the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which by 1987 was 8 years old. She talked to us about the saintliness of the Ayatollah Khomeini. Finally, a voice was standing up to the perversions and guiles of the Western Crusaders. She showed us photos of dead Iranian boys, their lifeless heads still wearing the green cloth bands of martyrdom, who had given their lives to uphold the Iranian Revolution. She took us to the Iranian embassy in Nairobi. We talked about going to Iran to do what we could for the Ayatollah, but when my mother found out we had been to the embassy, she was angry. Ma would never let me go to Iran among the Shia. At the debating center, we had long discussions about how to behave in daily life. There were so many rules with minutely detailed prescriptions, and so many authorities had pronounced on them. Truly, Muslim women should cover their bodies even in front of a blind man, even in their own houses. They had no right to walk down the middle of the street. They should not move out of their father's house without permission. I found it remarkable how many esteemed Muslim thinkers had philosophized at such length about precisely how much female skin could be bared without causing chaos to break out across the landscape. Of course, almost all these thinkers agreed that once a girl reaches puberty, every part of her body except her face and her hands must be covered when in the company of any men who are not immediate family and at all times outside the home. This was because her bare skin would involuntarily cause men to feel an uncontrollable frenzy of sexual arousal. But not all thinkers agreed on exactly which parts of a woman's face and hands were so beguiling that they must be covered. Some scholars held that the eyes of women were the strongest source of sexual provocation. When the Quran said women should lower their gaze, it actually meant they should hide their eyes. Another school of thought held that the very sight of a woman's lips, especially full ones that were firm and young, could bring a man into a sexual state that could cause his downfall. Yet other thinkers spent pages and pages on the sensual curve of the chin, a pretty nose, or long, slender fingers, and the tendency of some women to move their hands in a way that attracted attention to their temptations. For every limitation, the Prophet was quoted. Even when all women had been covered completely from head to toe, another line of thought was opened. For this was not enough. High heels tapped and could trigger in men the image of a woman's legs. To avoid sin, women must wear flat shoes that make no noise. Next came perfume. Using any kind of pleasant fragrance, even perfumed soap and shampoo, would distract the minds of men from Allah's worship and cause them to fantasize about sinning. The safest way to cause no harm to anyone seemed to be avoid contact with any man at all times and just stay in the house. A man's sinful erotic thoughts were always the fault of the woman who incited them. One day, I finally stood up and asked, "What about the men? Shouldn't they cover? Don't women also have desire for male bodies? Couldn't they be tempted by the sight of men's skin?" It seemed logical to me, but the whole room fell about laughing. There was no way I could go on with my objections. I was lonely without Hawea and Ferdowsa, and many of my school friends were avoiding me, uncomfortable with a religious freak in a black tent. I took to spending afternoons after school at Farah Gura's house. A whole gaggle of young women, his teenage daughters and girls from the Osman Mahmud clan who had just arrived from Somalia, lived there under the keen but benevolent eye of his wife, Fadumo. Several of the Somali girls at Fadumo's house were fresh from the Somali countryside or the provinces and were properly betrothed to good men of the clan. My mother thought they would be a fine influence on me, so she let me go to Farah Gura's house, as much as I liked. And I did like. It was my first contact with Somali girls from Somalia. One of these girls was Jawahir, who was quick, pretty, rather excitable. She was about 25 and had come to Nairobi to marry one of Farah Gura's truck drivers. She was waiting at Farah Gura's place for her husband-to-be to return to Nairobi from a five-month trip through Southern Africa. Ali was a dependable employee, and Fadumo needed Jawahir to feel happy in Nairobi. If Jawahir were miserable, she might persuade Ali to return to Somalia with her. So Fadumo asked me to show Jawahir around town and keep her company. Jawahir was tiny but exuberant, all airs and graces. She rolled her eyes and flounced her arms around, telling stories in her shrill voice. She inflicted everything with so much drama. Jawahir reminded me of the Isaaq women who mourned at the funeral of my aunt in Mogadishu under the talal tree. In fact, along with her Isaaq manner, she had even picked up an Isaaq accent from living in Hargeisa, where her parents settled for a while. Jawahir didn't read books. She was illiterate, but she was really amusing. A whole group of us met for long, giggly girls' conversations in the afternoons, while the older people napped with the children. The talk centered on Jawahir's impending marriage and the various prospects for other girls' marriages. And of course we talked about circumcision. All these girls knew they would be married soon. It was inevitable that we talk about our excisions. This was what we had been sewn up for. The talk was mostly boasting. All the girls said how tightly closed they were. This made them even more pure, doubly virginal. Jawahir was particularly proud of her circumcision. She used to say, "See the palm of your hand? I'm like that, flat, closed." One afternoon, gossiping about another girl, Jawahir said, "If you are walking past the toilet when she's in there, you can hear that she isn't a virgin. She doesn't drip. She pees loudly, like a man." We discussed our periods too, the sense of what made us filthy and unworthy of prayer. When we were menstruating, we weren't allowed even to pray or to touch the Quran. All the girls felt guilty for bleeding every month. It was proof that we were less worthy than men. We never actually talked about sex itself, the act that would take place on the marriage night, the reason why we had been sewn. Somalis almost never talk about sexuality directly. The subject is shameful and dirty. Sometimes, though, as Jawahir and I walked around the neighborhood, we would come across people, Kenyans, making out in broad daylight. Dainty little Jawahir would recoil. This was a nasty country. On other afternoons, Jawahir used to ask me to read to her out loud from the books I carried everywhere. She had never gone to school and books were strange to her. These books were mostly thrillers and mushy love stories, but all of them had sex scenes. I would read them to her, and she would sniff and say, "It's not like that for Muslims, we are pure." Jawahir's wedding took place at Farah Gura's house. All the women had elaborate calicues hennaed on their hands and were wearing gauze dira gowns. We danced together to a woman drama. I don't think the men danced or had music. We had a huge meal. Several sheep and goats were slaughtered, and in the evening, little Jawahir appeared in a white western dress with her hair piled up in a beehive. She was enjoying the attention. She loved to perform. For a week after the wedding, Ma wouldn't let me go to see Jawahir. She said it wouldn't be proper. So it wasn't until the next weekend that I visited her. Jawahir sat on the sofa, gingerly shifting her weight from one side of her bottom to the other. Finally, I asked her what it had been like having sex. She evaded the question. I was holding one of Halwa's Harlequin paperbacks, and she grabbed it and asked, "What is this filthy book you're reading?" I said, "Come on, you know all about it now. Tell me what it is like." Jawahir said, "Not until you read this book to me." It was a mild enough book about a man and a woman, a doomed romance, one or two sexy bits, but when the man and woman kissed, he put his hand on the woman's breast, and he then put his mouth to her nipple. Jawahir was horrified. "These Christians are filthy," she squeaked. This is forbidden for Muslims. It's not like that at all. Now, Jawahir really had to tell me what sex was like. She said it was awful. But after the wedding ceremony, they went into the bedroom of the flat that Ali had rented for them. Ali turned off the lights. Jawahir lay down on the bed, fully dressed. He groped under her dress, opened her legs, took off her underpants, and tried to push his penis inside her. He didn't cut her with a knife, just with his penis. It took a long time and hurt. This resembled the stories that Sahra had told me. Every night it was almost as painful and always the same. Ali would push inside, move up and down inside her, and then ejaculate. That was it. Then he would stand up and take a shower to purify himself. She would get up and shower, also to purify herself, and apply Dettol to the parts that were bleeding. That was Jawahir's sex life. This was nothing at all like the scenes I used to linger on in books. I was about to turn 18. I had reared myself on Harlequins and kissed Kennedy. What Jawahir described fell far short of the thrilling sex I had imagined. I was crestfallen and told her I would never get married. Jawahir laughed and said, "Wait until your father comes back one day, you'll see then." She seemed perfectly resigned to her life. Ali appeared to be a kind man, not violent or mean, and a decent provider. Jawahir seemed convinced that good women were forbidden by God to feel desire. I already knew what Sister Aziza would say about sex and marriage. She counseled many young married couples. Women often told her how horrible it was for them to have sex. Sister Aziza used to respond that they were complaining only because they had read licentious, un-Islamic descriptions of sexual experiences in Western books. We Muslim women were not to copy the behavior of unbelievers. We shouldn't dress like them or make love like them, or behave like them in any way. We should not read their books, for they would lead us off the straight, true path to Allah. A woman couldn't break marriage because it was awful or boring. That was utterly forbidden, and the way of Satan. If your husband hurts you, Sister Aziza would tell these women, you must tell him that and ask him to do it differently. If you cooperate, it will always be less painful. And if he's not hurting you, then count yourself among the lucky ones. At Abdullahi Ahmed's house, relations between Ma and Hanan were deteriorating. They had had a couple of spats early on, but Ma restrained herself. She knew if there was a big quarrel, we would have to leave the house. Then, in early 1988, we heard that once again open warfare had broken out in Somalia. In May, Siad Barre's forces began bombing Isaaq territory. Hanan turned into a witch. She was Isaaq, and she yelled that she didn't want a Darod woman in her house. We had certainly never considered Siad Barre a kinsman. Siad Barre was Darod, but he was from the Marehan, nothing close to my father's Osman Mahmud family or my mother's subclan, the Dulbahante. My mother tried to reason with Hanan. What Siad Barre was doing to the Isaaq in 1988, he had already done to my father's people 10 years before. All of us are victims of Siad Barre, my mother said. That's why we left our home, and that's why I am a beggar in this country with my children. But to make matters worse, as he was attacking the Isaaq, Siad Barre offered an amnesty to the Machertian fighters of the SSDF. Several prominent SSDF members took up the offer, some of them my own Osman Mahmud relatives. Jamal Musa's brother capitulated and became Siad Barre's minister for telecommunications. Hanan became impossible. Every day at 5 o'clock, just as I got home from school, the Somali service of the BBC would be turned up loud in the kitchen, announcing to Hanan how many Isaaq had died and how many were fleeing. In our bedroom, my mother and grandmother would be listening to the same thing. Hanan would start screaming, cursing the Dulbahante, the Machertian, and all Darod to hell and high places, and sometimes my mother would lose her cool and step out of our bedroom to confront her. These two wrinkled women would shout at each other among the pots and pans, my mother spitting out a poem she had invented on the spot, accusing Hanan of cowardice, and Hanan howling that my mother was a far worse coward because she had left Somalia so much longer ago. My grandmother would be in the kitchen too, pleading with them to stop it. And I would just creep out of the house to get away from the whole howling mess. Jawahir had been pleading with me to move in with her, to keep her company while Ali was away on long hauls, and to help her in the house. Fadumo knew about the situation at home. Nothing any Somali does is a secret, and interceded on my behalf. She told Ma that a young Somali matron like Jawahir would be the perfect companion for a growing girl. Even Ma could see how difficult it was for me to study at Abdullahi Ahmed's house. So I moved in with Jawahir just for a few months to prepare for my exams. I felt grown up. The house was in Eastleigh, the Somali neighborhood, so I remained under the watchful eye of the clan. Still, it was freer and calmer than the murderous atmosphere around Hanan and Ma. When her husband was home, Jawahir fluttered around, putting on pretty clothes and perfuming herself with frankincense. Ali never seemed to notice, but he was at least respectful and kind. While I was staying at Jawahir's house, two of Ali's co-workers proposed to me. It came as a surprise. The first time, Jawahir exploded with laughter at how taken aback I was.